Want to introduce our series in a little bit more depth as part of introducing Janet. We came upon this series titled Friendship, Distraction, and Hardiness: The Complexity of This Moment, because we wanted to spend the 10 weeks exploring what they are and how they relate to each other. And we've been looking at how friendships, having good friendships, solid friendships, is a part of feeling hardy and being hardy in these times. And that distractions can keep us from tending and strengthening our friendships. Or they can keep us, the distractions, from strengthening our hardiness. So we might choose to do something more passive, sitting down in front of a screen rather than outside taking a walk. And as you said, Paula, the body part of hardiness, the strengthening our actual bodies as well as our vistas. And then we've been looking at how friendship can fill in some places where we don't feel so hardy, where we might be vulnerable and have a need for friendship because we're not hardy in that place. Or, as you said, Paula, to help us with stressful times. But distraction can also be a fun way to spend time with ourselves or with our friend or in nature. So distraction has different sides as well. And we all felt that hardiness is a learning from this pandemic and helps us to meet these times and helps us to help each other. So we've been looking at different kinds of hardiness and friendship, with our own bodies, with our own hearts, spiritually, with something greater than we all are, with each other, with family, with our relationship to nature and how we tend that. So that's what we've been about. This is our ninth week and our final couplet. So we invited Janet Cooper Nelson to speak with us in her wise voice and deep experience for this couplet. And we're very lucky she said yes. The Reverend Janet M. Cooper Nelson is chaplain of the university, director of the Office of Chaplains and Religious Life, and faculty member at Brown University. Appointed in 1990, after appointments at Vassar College, Mount Holyoke College, and the Church of Christ in Dartmouth College. As Brown's chaplain, she leads a multi-faith team of associate chaplains and oversees the university's broad circle of religious life affiliates who advise student religious organizations. Together, they endeavor to ensure that a diversity of belief has voice and vitality throughout the university community, and that Brown's largest educational program is infused with an opportunity to enrich religious literacy and experience with the practice of religion. She earned degrees at Wellesley College, Tufts University, and Harvard Divinity School, as well as serving on the Divinity School's visiting committee and leadership council. Ordained in 1980 by the United Church of Christ, Janet's work is anchored in academic settings and examines interfaith collaboration, advocacy, religious identity and literacy, education, ethics, and grief. Her recent publications include Dearly Beloved, in the My Neighbor's Faith: Stories of Interreligious Encounter, Growth, and Transformation, in 2012, edited by Jennifer Howe Peace, Orr Rose, and Greg Mobley. Her professional associations have included Home and Hospice Care of Rhode Island, the Association of College and University Religious Affairs, AIDS Project Rhode Island, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Education as Transformation, and Women and Infants Hospital Institutional Research Board. And I read those mostly just so you begin to grasp the range of what Janet's involved in. So we welcome you, Janet Cooper Nelson, one more time.
Well, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be with you all. I have to say, this is a group of women that, when I think about your expertise and the range of ways you see the world and are interested in the world, I know this is a conversation we could launch into for an afternoon, not just an hour. I need to say, Paula, thank you so much for your reflection, but especially for it being at least in large measure about your mom. And I say that because mine begins right where you left off with my mom. The number of times I have heard my mother, who has been dead since 2014, say the words, "Well, you can't put that in. It's not hearty." I can't even count the number of times that she's told me that I'm doing the wrong thing in my garden. My mother finished high school after attending 10 schools at the age of 16. Her family was largely populated by
women. I'm okay, thanks, except my earpods aren't working.
Karen, can you mute yourself? Thanks. Sorry, Janet.
That's all right. Her family was poor, and her mother was gone by the time my mother was just in her early 20s. They had made it through the Depression. And how in the world she got interested in gardening is something that my sister and I still marvel that we don't know the answer to. Because they never lived in a place for long enough that there would have been a garden growing up. And the conversation around my grandmother, which was always dear and important to my mother, never included gardening. So I expect that that's not the source of the interest. I know that my mom's oldest sister married a man who was an incredible gardener, and Mom and Uncle Bob did all kinds of things together gardening wise. And I regret, one of my bigger regrets in life is that the range of little tiny boxwood plants that my mom was nourishing at her house at the time that I was the person insisting they move to Rhode Island, I just should have dug the suckers up and brought them to Rhode Island, because she'd been at it for a long time and I didn't do it, and they're still there. And I bet the people who moved in just either bulldozed them or did something. I want to tell you there were 80 of them. This is my mom. My mom was about 5'1". She weighed about 85 pounds, and she lived to be just shy of 97 years of age. And she didn't have antibiotic until she was in her 90s. Made her throw up. We never did that again. She ultimately died of cancer, which was really, as cancers go, quite a gentle process. Her dementia shielded her from the one surgery. Not that she missed the surgery, but she missed remembering it, which was lovely. And she recovered it well. And her days in the garden continued until the summer she died. She died on Labor Day. Literally, I think, knowing that my brown year was about to begin and her adventures and mine were beginning to take all of my time, and there wasn't much she could do to help anymore, which was actually the part of getting older that bothered her most. In the garden, she knew everything. When she and my dad moved here to Rhode Island in 2005, their tiny 30 by 30 brick bungalow about 10 miles outside Philadelphia, on a plot of land that was about 10,000 square feet, had 5,000 separate varieties of plants and flowers and trees. She was especially fond of trees. And I have to tell you, when your house takes up much of your lot and you just keep putting in trees like Grandiflora magnolia and others, pretty soon my sister and I got the idea that we should just blow the house up and try to deed the garden to the neighborhood as a park. But it turns out, just in case you're ever inclined to think about doing such a thing, you will run into all manner of authorities who don't agree with you. We then went approach Swarthmore College, where she did a lot of gardening, about maybe they would take it over, and they would be happy to take it over if we gave them an endowment to maintain it. So perhaps you work for institutions or know about these things. Mom's garden went with the house to the next people who lived there, and the money that came out of the house became the bit of money that she and Dad needed to live out the rest of their lives, right down to the last $3,000, which was exactly how she managed her money. But I started you with the question, or the statement, that I heard repeatedly from her: that's not hardy. You can't plant it. And I start there with my remarks because I think when we think about hardiness, our own, certainly the garden, it is really absolutely incumbent upon us to think about climate. So often when I hear people pastorally faulting themselves for not being able to weather some personal storm, some illness that they have, some way that life has hit them really hard, I don't hear them being what my mother was, which was enormously respectful of what you can't change. The weather, the temperature range, all kinds of things that surround you and frankly don't ask your permission. They are simply there. So I will see if I'm any good at sharing my screen. My staff think this is really funny that I've managed to make it this far through COVID and not been gotten good at this. But I want to show you something. I think if you're a gardener, you know what I'm about to show you very well. So just in case it doesn't work, you will. But hang on here while I try to share my screen. Let's see. All kinds of things that are not what I want to do. Hang on a minute. Stay with me. I think this is what I want. One more minute here. Let me just, I may have to go grab somebody to help me do this. why this is working. It worked a minute ago. That. Oh, nuts. I'm going to call somebody in and see if they can help me get it on the screen for you. Hang on one second. Thank you. So what am I doing wrong? I told them I want to share it, but I don't know where that file is.
See, part of hardiness is having just the right person to help you.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. I hope now you're seeing it.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm guessing that you know this map pretty well, or at least you've seen something like it. But part of why I wanted you to see it today is because these are a set of maps about hardiness. Particularly cold hardiness. And I know you to be scholars enough to realize these maps don't agree with each other. Take a look closely. There are general rules about which parts of the world, especially if you look at the map on the top left, right? You can see the zones numbered. But you may know about your growing zone what I know about mine, and my mother was quick to tell me, which is that while Rhode Island fits in a particular zone, 5 or 6, growers begin to add letters to these zones, 5A, 6B, and that has to do with all kinds of other factors, wind, wetness, ways that you can, in fact, titrate for light. And then things you can do to ameliorate a condition that may be too tough for the hardiness of what you're trying to grow with mulch, even snow, binding up with burlap. Perhaps you've seen that happen as people take their evergreens and try to protect them from the burnout that can come in the winter. But whatever the approach is, and if you yourself are an expert gardener, please forgive me for butchering all this. My mother, if she's listening in, is definitely saying, okay, Janet, you're close to right here, but you could really be giving a more nuanced picture of this. But the hardiness zones of our nation and of the world are really quite variable from year to year, and they are, as the environment changes, changing right along with them. So some trees that I put in about 6 or 8 years before my mom died, that are now getting to be quite huge. She gave me the first one and I added some others. They're called cryptomeria. They are an evergreen. They blow beautifully in the wind and they give you a nice barrier between you and your neighbor if you need it for hardiness, right? It's important not only that you put in something that survives well, but also something that does what you want it to do. And in this case, my neighbor's porch was in my bedroom. So I kind of wanted a little break from that. And so did she. But what mom knew was that those trees were mostly hardy, thriving in North Carolina. So she, of course, had to try one in the Philadelphia area and brought me the one that's in my front yard from the Swarthmore plant sale because she was convinced it would work. It's 45 feet tall, and I would say she was right. I put some more in at the backyard. I'm going to try and unshare my screen now. Let's see if I can do that. Oh, I'm so bad at this. I apologize. But I really wanted to put this up here to just show you that while you develop expertise that assists in hardiness, I think the question that we all have to ask ourselves is what information, what learning can we do from a variety of sources, psychological, spiritual, environmental, that take seriously the climate that we're in, while also taking seriously what it is we are striving to do. In my mother's case, her garden was absolutely an initiative that I do find my own is as well, of sort of defying the climate. I'm forever trying to stretch the limits of what the climate predictions will be. So I thought today I would tell you a little bit about a few failures because they have taught me a lot. My resort in this, in Mom's case, would have taken you to botany books and various gardening resources. Mine invariably takes me to poetry, which may not be the very best place to learn gardening, but it's just where my heart goes. So one of my rather dramatic failures over the years is rooted in my love of figs. And in fact, you can grow figs in the Northeast, but not without some work and some extra care. And in my case, without Joe. Joe is my neighbor who used to run a computer company. And after his 10th trigger finger surgery, all 10 fingers, he thought to himself, why in the devil am I continuing to do this? I love my garden. I'm going to retire. I'll get to see my dad in the Azores much more often, and I'm going to start a business, which I'll call Tree of Life. As a credentialed arborist, he began to show up in neighbors' yards, and that's where I met Joe. I love telling the fact that I met him in a tree because it's true. My neighbors, he was pruning. I said, can you help me? And the answer was yes. And I'm now growing a fig tree. But my fig tree, having failed at this process over and over and over, included Joe saying to me, Janet, you cannot just ignore the wind and the cold that comes every year. And we can resort to your garage, or you can bring this over and over, and soon my instructions came. But here I want to break with the horticultural image to take you, as I said, I do, to poetry. This poem comes from a collection which I'm happy to share. It's called Bite Every Sorrow. And there's kind of some cool dogs on the front. The collector is the poet is Barbara Ross, R-A-S. And she entitles this poem, which maybe you won't see as about hardiness, but to me, I think it is. This is a poem entitled, You Can't Have It All. You can't have it all, but you can have the fig tree and its fat leaves like clown hands gloved with green. You can have the touch of a single 11-year-old finger on your cheek, waking you at 1 a.m. to say the hamster is back. You can have the purr of the cat and the soulful look of the black dog, the look that says, if I could, I would bite every sorrow until it fled. And when it is August, you can have it, August, and abundantly so. You can have love, though often it will be mysterious, like the white foam that bubbles up at the top of a bean pot over the kidney beans, until you realize foam's twin is blood. You can have the skin at the center between a man's legs, so solid, so doll-like. You can have the life of the mind, glowing occasionally in priestly vestments, never admitting pettiness, never stopping to bribe the sullen guard who will tell you all roads narrow at the border. You can speak a foreign language sometimes, and it can mean something. You can visit the marker on the grave where your father wept openly. You can't bring back the dead, but you can have the words forgive and forget, hold hands as if they meant to spend a lifetime together. And you can be grateful for makeup, the way it kisses your face, half spice, half amnesia. Grateful for Mozart, his many notes racing one toward joy, for towels sucking up the drops on your clean skin, and for deeper thirsts for passion fruit, for saliva. You can have the dream of Egypt, the horses of Egypt, and you riding in the hot sand. You can have your grandfather sitting on the side of your bed, at least for a while. You can have clouds and letters, the leaping of distances, and Indian food with yellow sauce like sunrise. You can't count on grace to pick you out of a crowd. But here is your friend to teach you how to high jump, how to throw yourself over the bar backwards until you learn about love, about sweet surrender. And here are periwinkles, buses that kneel, farms in the mind as real as Africa. And when adulthood fails you, you can still summon the memory of the black swan on the pond of your childhood, the rye bread with peanut butter and bananas that your grandmother gave you while the rest of the family slept. There is a voice you can still summon at will, like your mother's. It will always whisper, you can't have it all. But there is this. Hardiness to me has a great deal to do with my mother telling me, that's not hardy here, but you can have this. What is the color in the garden, Janet, you're trying to add? Because lobelia, it mostly disappoints. There are some people who can grow it, and it's an amazing color. But every time you bring it home from the nursery, somehow it seems to dry out and get spindly and not be nearly as spectacular as you want. But if it's that color you want, you can have it this way. And she'd add something else to the garden, which is, of course, how it got to have 5,000 species in it. They weren't all perfectly weeded. Her gardens didn't look like something out of France or Britain that came with a whole set of people who gardened for her. She was the gardener. But if you were looking for her in the morning, before the endless hours of work she put in so that we could go to school and not to 10 different schools, if you were looking for her out among those tiny little boxwoods that she told me would make the perfect hedge for my garden, but she'd grow them for me for a while first. She was in heaven. She was where she wanted to be. She was hardy. Her life was not a life of hardiness. She lost almost everything that most of us think of as the things you should have to count yourself fortunate or to count yourself wealthy, accomplished, recognized, none of it. She was the second sister. She married a man who was larger than life in his failures as well as in his personality, and beloved by us, but difficult. As my life went along, and I began to actually see the profile of my mother's life and to see how it was she remained hardy, this question kept forming. I worked at it a lot, trying to figure out how to ask her. and determined not to be the daughter who had never asked it. My question to her was, did you ever want to be first? Did you ever want to be the person that actually got the best bite of something, the opportunity to do something? Because it seemed to me in every respect in life, she was the second sister. My mother's name was Frances, and people always called her, including my cousins, I have 23 of them, Aunt Sis. I thought it was the end of her name, Frances. It wasn't. It was that she was everybody's sister. She was Aunt Sis at church. She was Aunt Sis to my friends, to neighbors who never knew her as a sister or a cousin or a relative of any kind. She was Sis. Sometimes she was Murph. She was a Murphy. And when I dearly needed a gerontologist here in Rhode Island for her and for my dad, the fact that John Murphy would take her on as a patient, for anybody who's from Rhode Island, he was at the time the head of Rhode Island Hospital, was nothing short of a miracle, because Mom wasn't so crazy about doctors. But with a name like Murphy, he could be trusted. So she was Murph, or she was Sis, or Aunt Sis. But she was never first. Not in any way that I can see. So one day at a place no more auspicious than Newport Creamery, again, you have to be a Rhode Islander. It's kind of like a Friendly's. There aren't too many of them left. At Newport Creamery, over coffee ice cream, her favorite, having screwed together my courage and thought about the fact that I better not get too philosophical or she'd do something weird, or I screwed up my courage and said, Mom, this is serious. I need to know this from you. Did it ever bother you that you were never first? I kind of knew she'd know what I meant, or at least I hoped she would. And she looked at me, taking a great big mouth of ice cream, dip of ice cream, not yet in her mouth. And she said, you know, first is not what it's cracked up to be. I didn't have a second question. I wasn't in any way ready for that response. But Hardy isn't first. Hardiness is not about winning. Hardiness is about enduring, persevering, persisting, getting through some growing season or temperature range when it's gotten too cold or too dry or too windy. It's finding Joe in the tree next door and being able to say to him, I just keep failing at figs. You're Portuguese. You know about figs. You say, you can grow figs. Here, I'll get you a fig tree. And then last fall, Joe saying, where's your fig tree, Janet? I said, well, it's out on the back porch. He said, well, it's getting to be time to bring it in. I said, I thought you said that to me this was hardy. He looked at me and he said, it is. How is it hardy if I have to bring it in? And he said to me, coffee ice cream kind of answer, how is it not? Bring it in. Hardiness is about adapting. Hardiness is about being humble in the face of things you're not going to be able to change. Remember the serenity prayer? We think of hardiness as being some damn tough guy who just stands out there with a bare naked chest and gets through the whole year without ever coming inside. Why is that hardy? I think in the words of Plato, in those Socratic dialogues, you might add another word on the front of that word. It would be not courageous, but foolhardy. That dialogue of Plato, the Meno, tries to help us walk the line between what is brave and what's nuts. We must, in the climate sense of things, take seriously the need to prune away the things that culturally we are told are hardiness, understand the real green livingness of us and of everything and learn how to protect it. Hardiness is not something I can do by myself. I not only need Joe from the tree and more knowledge than I have, but I need an orientation that tells me what time of year it is and what needs to be done then. You get those notices too. They come from your doctor. Janet, it's been 10 years since you had a colonoscopy. Time to go back. Not my favorite note, but somebody is watching with me for my hardiness. You head to the doctor and get some blood tests or whatever happens, and you get told, there's something a little strange there. And we head back in. I know I mentioned that Mom never had antibiotic until she was in her 90s. Her theory about doctors was you don't go and then you don't hear the bad things they tell you. We all thought that was pretty funny. My sister's a physician. I spend an awful lot of my time teaching at Brown's Medical School. This was comical to us. She never got bad news. She wasn't, for the most part, sick. And she grew up in a family where sickness was everywhere. And she was always the person caring for it. Only later did I think, this is Mom, the competitor, who thinks, damn it, you are someone I love. Do not go to the doctor and learn something hard because I just can't go there. It's too hard for me. Her sister, her mother, her dad, and on through the family. Cancer, dementias, many hard things beyond the fact that they had no money and very little stepping stone in the world. She and my dad forged a fierce alliance, but that came with addiction, alcoholism, and lots more struggle until their footing got more strong. She wasn't first. Boy, was she hardy. She was someone who watched for what you needed, whether you were her church buddy or her neighbor. She was quick to find the people who would, like Joe in the tree, instruct her about how to make her garden thrive. Every plant she put out there came with a story. Who gave it to her, where it came from, why it was going to work. When she retired beyond the garden outside, she turned the entire basement, with my dad's help, into a place to grow gesneriads and African violets, and then studied for how to judge at the flower show. It became a huge burgeoning process, an education, really, and an introduction. Never much of somebody who liked the garden club for all the clubbiness of it, but the Barnes Foundation, where you could learn horticulture for free in Philly, pretty great. Hardiness has to do, it seems to me, in the emotional and the spiritual sense, it has to do with knowing how to choose the things into your life that will strengthen you. How to be aware of what it is that's coming down because of the climate, because of the bugs that have infested it, because of who knows what. And finding a way for your growth and strength to be accentuated. I don't know whether the name Agnes DeMille means anything. It didn't to me. But the next thing I'm going to say, I'm pretty sure will connect for you. Agnes DeMille was the person who choreographed the show Oklahoma. She was one of the most successful Broadway choreographers in a time when women didn't get to do this. And Oklahoma was just, as many of you may remember, an absolute stunning success on Broadway, made all kinds of money, was ultimately made into a film, and it really rocketed Agnes into an area that she was quite surprised by. She says in a conversation with Martha Graham, I'm going to count on the fact that that name means something, but Martha was an extraordinary force in the world of ballet and dance. And Agnes DeMille and Martha Graham are speaking together, and Agnes says that she confessed she had a burning desire to be excellent, but no faith that she could be. And Martha Graham replies, thank goodness Agnes records this for us, there is a vitality, a life force an energy, a quickening that is translated through you into action. And because there is only one of you in all of time, this expression is unique. If you block it, it will never exist through any other medium, and it will be lost. The world will not have it. It is not your business to determine how good it is, nor how valuable, nor how it compares with other expressions. It is your business to keep it yours clearly and directly, and to keep the channel open. You do not even have to believe in yourself or your work. You have to keep yourself open and aware to the urges that motivate you. Keep the channel open. And as for you, Agnes, you have so far used about one third of your talent. Agnes replies, when I see my work, I take for granted what other people value in it. I see only its ineptitude, inorganic flaws and crudities. I'm not pleased or satisfied. Martha Graham replies, no artist is pleased. But then there's no satisfaction, says DeMille. No satisfaction whatever at any time. There is only a queer, divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive than any of the others. These two women, wouldn't it have been wonderful to sit in and listen to that conversation about hardiness? Here is DeMille at the height of success, saying, all I see is the things that are wrong. I see all the mistakes. And Martha Graham saying to her, so what? Keep going. What's coming through you can come through no one else. And if you don't let it come through, if you don't keep having your hardiness in whatever form it exists, these are two names we all know, they're famous people, we always resort to those folks. But it could be that the hardiness coming through you is coming through this group. It's coming in the conversations that every time I come to this group, I hear. People talking deeply and sincerely and honestly one with the other about how life is going. Gardens, mothers, theology, the environment, care. Strengthening these qualities in ourselves such that they can come through us and turn into a fig tree growing in the backyard. I don't know how important that is. I'm pretty sure to my mom it's pretty important. If it ever grows a fig, I'm going to call you up because we're actually going to sit down and eat them. I love them. I'm not convinced that it can happen. It's still pretty small. Maybe it'll work. I failed at rosemary. Maybe you can keep rosemary alive. I throw the plant out every year. Buy a bigger one. Sure that this year, if I get a bigger one, a sturdier one, I'll wrap it up. I'll do it. It still dies. I don't water it. I do water it. And it always smells good as I'm throwing it out. I don't know if you've noticed that. The last one to hit the compost pile last week, I thought to myself, well, if nothing else, my hands smell really good as I dump it with the rest of the things I've managed to do in last winter, the things I'm cleaning up. It occurred to me later I should have put it in the fire pit because I'm guessing that would have smelled really good. But my hands smelled really good. But I think it might be, I don't know, 20 rosemaries that have passed through my hands and not one of them has made it through the year. And if you're good at them, would you please tell me how to do it? Because I'm really bad. My neighbor claimed she could keep one alive, but when she saw me throwing mine out, she said, yeah, mine died too. It can't be that we run screaming out of the room declaring nothing is hardy because of death. Because the one thing that you and I all know about each other sitting here today is that we all die. My mother has died. Her wisdom about hardiness, about firstness, about persevering, about overpopulating with gorgeous growing things, a space that's much too small, about being imprudent in every way toward life and never worrying about whether you're authorized, educated, properly funded, acknowledged. They were never her ideas or priorities, but her persistence and most of all, her joy. Bleary-eyed in that tiny little house when they still lived there, I would come down from the second floor in search of coffee, which was readily available in their house always. And before I could even get the first cup in my mouth, my mother would say, "Come, you have to see what I'm doing in the garden." And we'd be out prowling around. Summers in Philadelphia are great occasions for getting eaten by mosquitoes. I was not walking through a manicured place that would be a show place. I was walking through my mom's garden. And what was there to see and what she was working on and why some little patch of it was particularly important at that moment was a function of her engagement with it. It was a function of her decision that this space needed to become more hardy, more strong, and was for a woman whose time was always overspoken for, would become the place that she would work. I turned for sort of the closing section of what I want to talk to you about, because I do think fundamentally hardiness, our resilience, is about literally looking squarely in the face of grief, loss, death, and knowing that it comes. To live in denial about all of that, to assume that hardiness has failed because people we love have died or that we will die, it doesn't seem to me to be anything other than foolish. But a recent poem that someone shared with me, which I have the text for, and I'm going to try now and see if I can share it with you too while I read it to you, is called The Flame Tree. I don't think you're seeing it yet, right? Let's see if I can make it work. Maybe. No, I will just read it to you and share it later. Never mind. Instead of grabbing my friend, I will just read this to you. So this is written by Evelyn Flores. Evelyn is a Chamorro poet. She lives on Guam. She's the co-editor of Indigenous Literatures from Micronesia that was recently published by the University of Hawaii. And there is a word in this poem that I want to tell you about before I read it to you, because I had to learn about it. I didn't know this word. The word is Fanomnakan, Fanomnakan, and it is from the Chamorro language, and it basically refers to the dry season, the sunny season. So there's a rainy season and there's a dry season, and that's what she's talking about when she gets to that word. But this poem is entitled The Flame Tree. And the writer again is Evelyn Flores. My neighbor has decided to poison the flame tree. He's right, of course. The tree is over 20 years old, huge, spreading, and the termites have worn jagged roads clear to its top. It's clearly a danger tilting toward our house. Some fickle wind, my neighbor says, could blow it over. Every Fanomnakan, it sends out its bursts of orange blossoms. It blooms and blooms and blooms relentlessly. The flares it sends shooting out into space more stunning than fireworks through the window where my mother, riveted to a bed, doomed by her body to a colorless spot, gazes out, her head on a pillow. Might have seemed like forever to her who used to climb green mountainsides and watches the tree full of sparrows, chittering, chattering, flitting here and there, and the outlandish blazing petals steadfastly singing against the blue sky. My neighbor, true to his word, injected a poisonous brew bought at Home Depot into the trunk of the tree. The toxic river traveling up, 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 following the termite trails to the heart of the fire. He's right, of course. But the tree came back the following year, its clusters unflinchingly parading their bursts of rebellious orange. But the poison had done its work. See, where the canopy of flames, there are now just a handful here and there. One spray in particular, desperately reaching out like a fistful of beauty to the window where she used to watch for its return. Orange, blue, flames, lobelia, the colors of a garden will perennially return. Those watching for them may not. But the gardens are the hardiness. Our privilege to participate in them for the time of our lives where we are the gardeners. These, in my judgment, are the works of God. These are the opportunities to be aligned with what may be some united and uniting act of hardiness that each generation of human beings can contribute to a flow of life that is far greater than us. A flow of life that brought us to birth, but a flow of life that will also carry us out of the world to death. But the colors, the plants, the hardiness, the climate, the growing zones, even as they shift and are nuanced so that the cryptomeria that used to only bloom or only grow in North Carolina as a windbreak on golf courses, it turns out, now grows nicely in Rhode Island. Our great-grandchildren will tell a story of what didn't grow in our gardens and what now grows in theirs. When my husband talks of moving south, I tell him we don't need to. South is moving toward us. It's still too cold in the winter for him. But the seasons of the gardens please us both. He hangs out with vegetables. For me, it's largely flowers. Although this year I did put in potatoes. My mother was basically the person who, if you were interested in gardening, she already liked you. She already had something to talk to you about. And she already hoped that you would talk to her. And she'd wait to see what it was about. My dad would complain that she'd often start something at the dinner table that he had absolutely no idea what the context was. And he was right. Part of it was a dementia that began to advance. But part of it was what she'd learned from the neighbor around the corner who had a bush she'd never seen, where there was a color in the garden that she was shocked by. And that was always a bridge for her to approach you and ask, what's that? Where did it come from? Where did you get it? Can I have a seed? I cleaned the china cupboard last year because the room had to be painted and we had to disassemble everything. In the bottom of a few tiny little vases, I found what I thought was dirt. I looked more closely. Seeds. My mother was always bringing seeds from everywhere. I have no idea what they grow, but I will try. There are six sets of them. I've looked at them closely under a microscope, under a magnifying glass, and they're different. I'll tell you later what they are, if I can make them sprout. She's gone. I'd love to show them to her. It's 8 years. Is she watching while I garden? I don't know. But I have to tell you, if she could shout across the threshold of eternity, she'd be saying, are those the ones I brought back from your brothers? I think we were at Half Moon Bay. It's probably a conifer. I shook out the pine cone. This is what was in there. I don't know if it's hardy in your area. I don't know if it can grow where you are. But you could try. We can try. We can, together, grow a world, not just plants, not just our own small lives. We can grow a world together in different languages, in different climates, in different environments. We can grow a world that is hardy emotionally and spiritually. Paul is right that a key to doing that is empathy. That's exactly what drove my mother to your driveway to notice that something new was in your garden. She knew by seeing that growing empathically that you must be a gardener. And I heard more than once in my life, I have no idea what that is or where it came from the person she was questioning. So perhaps it was a weed. But to Mom, it was new and it was thriving. And it was blooming, and it was worthy of notice. These are the qualities that in us enable the days that were granted, however many or few, to be days of emotional joy and emotional engagement and connection to the world and climate we're living in. But I think empowered, they become the tools by which we generate a climate, generate a growing zone that doesn't just have a number, but is actually capable of growing all of us over a period of time that is far beyond any one lifetime. So I suppose your invitation to think about hardiness for me began to push me to think about what's the difference between an annual and a perennial. The perennials keep coming up, even when they need to be weeded out, divided, moved. They keep coming back. My hope for our hardiness is that we can be planted in such a way, in a zone, such that we aren't just annuals. But I've learned actually about a few annuals that I didn't bring inside, that they often seed themselves. So while they may not be perennial, they may have dropped just enough stuff in the dirt that the next year you see them again. And since the South is marching north and the East is marching west and the dryness is going from one place to another, it's not up to us to determine the growing zones. It's up to us to grow. That's what Martha Graham said. If you don't do the growing that is only yours to do, the world will never receive it. We will be deprived of your hardiness. And it's not measured in years. It's not measured in books that you put on the shelf, although it might be, or dance steps, or recognition. It is literally, uniquely, and specifically yours. So I hope the hardiness of this amazing group, I found myself thinking about Elizabeth Dodson Gray and many of the faces and voices no longer can I see on the screen, but they are the seeds and the perennials in this garden of women growing over many years. I see Britta Stendahl. I see we could keep going. And maybe some who are alive and well, I pray, but not present today. That circle of what's now called Women Explore, which used to be the TOP program. I can hear Elizabeth at church at Wellesley College telling us about the TOP program and David looking on. They were young, we were younger. This is a garden. This is a hearty garden of thoughtful, engaged people committed to some kind of perseverance, some kind of weathering of storms, some sort of growing and thriving that clearly is of something much bigger than us. I have one more piece I want you to hear, and this time I am going to get help so I turn it on, but this is just a wonderful piece of music that somebody sent me that really in some ways exemplifies this notion that we could become a growing zone. So let me just ask for a little help and then you'll hear it. I want to share this. It was a video.
I wanna see the world united and learn to live as one. I wanna see the world united, learn to live as one. I wanna see the world united, learn to live as one. I wanna see the world united, learn to live as one. La la, le ando, stengeli na mato, bakufela kizumba. Zungisa, le ando, na mituna ya mato, bakufela nzala. La la. We have to bring the world together and learn to live as one. We have to bring the world together, learn to live as one.
Together.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Janet. That's quite a metaphor to keep chewing over, too.
I can turn anyone into a beach ball.
Whoops, sorry.
I bring families together.
So we have some time together to ask Janet questions, to talk about what was evoked for you as Janet talked about the garden and the growing seasons and the growing zones. So who would like to go? Lee?
Janet, two statements that came to my mind, one of which from you, you said, one of which I've heard frequently. First one is, grow where you are planted. The second one was your mother's statement, I don't think that's hardy here. How do you reconcile those two statements?
It's funny that you say that, because Mom used to say that the best way to have a garden you would really love is to notice what grows in the garden by well and then grow more of it. Which was partly her recognition that there would be some things that would just, you know, every year I put in lupin, and about every third year they actually make it. So the grow where you're planted, I think is just really, you know, an important part of my question to her of, did it ever make you nutty that you weren't first? I mean, she had to grow where she was planted. You do, I do. You know, we don't have all of the choices in the world. And I think we can decide to chafe at the setting we're in and make that our cause. And for some people, I mean, when you watch those musicians, I find myself just, partly because I manage lots of things, I think, who in the world figured out where all those people were to get them to make that video? Right. And then coordinated them all and communicated with them all and whatever. So, I mean, I think if your project is to make that video and you can analogize that to the where that you're planted and that's your project, you push hard at the climate, it seems to me, to make it work for you and to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. I think that's Martha Graham's advice to Agnes DeMille. You know, you've got to do this. Don't worry about whether it's any good. Just do it, because you're the only person who can do what it is you're supposed to do. But I think that the grow where you're planted is an admonition to try to be patient, to try and put up with the things that are not in your environment. And then I think, you know, Mom's advice was, you know, give it a shot.
Thank you.
But of course, give it a shot knowing you can fail dramatically. I have lots of those on my list.
Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. That's what my husband says all those flower pots are by the driveway. I tell him, I said, that's a record of my failures. Some of them went in the garden and made it. They're not all failures.
Sure. Virginia, you're muted.
I was thinking after you said that, make the best of what you have, not what you don't have. You know,
it's about the mothers. Go ahead.
The mothers. Very few people mentioned, or I don't know what's going through people's minds, but do you associate this hardiness and inspiration with fathers nearly so much as mothers. There's a contrast, but the mothers, I don't know if it's our connection as women or what, but I have a very strong sense of the mothers in my past, whether they were my mothers or not. And I just learned that, I don't know how they've determined this and who, but we go back about 14 generations in our spirit of artiness in our families.
Wow.
It's like that gumption, the strong, the will to do it, whatever it is. And that's significant. However they determine this. Very strong. And I don't feel very strong right now, but it's under there.
Yeah. We know it in you, Virginia.
Let their spirit, their strength flow through you. You know,
yes.
Just leaning back and saying those 14 generations of hardy, strong, artistic people behind me are, I'm just going to lean on them for a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Mary Margaret.
I was just with my grandsons this past weekend, and the four-year-old, I'm trying to teach him the song, "You Don't Always Get What You Want." Remember that one? Or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, if you're parenting, how do you find that balance between helping people, or, you know, just as a friend, accept what is, it is what it is, accept what is, with, you know, be the best you can be, you know, have encouragement, you can do it, keep going, you know, follow your dream. It seems to me it's a tough balance.
I agree, but I think that song is the perfect one, right? Don't always get what you need, you know, but if you try sometime, you just might get what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's, first of all, I love the song, so good for you. But I think the notion that it's balance, I don't know, some of the kids these days, I mean, they've been around for a while, but I only recently stepped onto one of them. It looks a little bit like a skateboard, except the roller is in the middle. Have you ever stepped on one of those? Those are really tough, I find. If I hold onto a wall, I can kind of get my balance, but you're literally shifting back and forth. And I think the idea that balance, even something as apparently concrete as hardiness, it's not guaranteed, right? Even if you've done everything right, it's not guaranteed. When I would do everything right and the thing I put in the garden died anyway, Mom would look at me and go, you know, they're not always healthy when you get them. I think, oh yeah, that's a good point. But I know that about people. But I don't always think about that in situations. I just this morning responded to a reference check for someone. And this person has gone through a very difficult time. And in fact, had to, you know, leave work that they'd been doing for quite a long time and really had such a sense of nothing good is going to happen. This reference check is the first little periscope I've seen go up, but it's a mark of a real step forward. And I think it could work. And it's in an entirely different direction. And I have no idea how this person was wise enough or resilient enough to figure out that maybe that was the answer. But I do think imagination, creativity is part of talking about that balance, that you may be trying very hard to go in a particular direction. And maybe the way forward to hardiness, to success, to resilience is in another direction. Just stop batting your head on that stone wall. And I think particularly about that in parenting. I'm sure everyone else's children were perfectly amenable to every, you know, direction they tried to impart. Mine were not. And, you know, when my son was just, and I think, wait, how about if I stop opposing him and think of some other way we can go after this? Do something else. Just redirect. I have to say, as somebody who leads a fair number of projects at this point in my life, redirection is often really important for colleagues, but it's often really important for Janet. Like, I just have to kind of think about a problem another way. And just that reminder of the way I'm trying to persevere, the idea that I have about what success would look like, what if it's not? This morning, in trying to finish up our baccalaureate service, you know, the answer was actually to take an element that was just giving us fits and say, what if we don't do this at all? Instead of trying to solve all the problems, well, one of the people involved in that looked back at us across the screen as though I had just given him the best present ever. And I thought my job was to figure out how he could do what he wanted. What he really wanted was not to do it at all. And that was a perfectly possible answer. I just wasn't seeing it. I thought I needed to come up with a snare drum set. I needed to figure out how to get the people who worry about egress in the building to imagine that all this stuff I wanted to jam in a corner would work. Everything about the situation was problematic. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, was, what if we just don't do this? Bingo. We were off the call in 10 minutes, which was lovely. I was planning for an hour. And we don't have to do any of that stuff. And the guy who I thought might be most disappointed is looking back at us like, thank you, Jesus. Right. Note to self, back up. Look again, be creative. I'm so used to persevering, soldiering through, right? You have to almost knock on my wooden head.
Thank you.
And we're all doing it together. Which is the other thing right now on this call. Humor. Oh my goodness. Humor is, if we could bottle it and put it on everybody's shelf, it would make such a difference if we could just find some humor in something.
And stories make a difference. Having a story to tell about something that doesn't feel very good. Having another story to tell that's about it, but not really about it, but is about it, you know? Yeah.
I can only imagine the story that the guy who was so pleased this morning is telling his family. Thank God that loony woman at Brown's figured out we shouldn't even try to do this, right? With any luck at all, it won't get all the way back to me because it's okay.
Or who knows what else he brings the story home, and who knows what else the family says, well, let's not do this other thing either. Why are we stuck with that? It can be contagious, right?
Well, the freedom to change your mind,
yeah,
to go another direction, to just try something else.
Or to find out you can live with what you can't have.
Yep.
Live without it. Yeah.
And that can be even in moments as difficult, as freighted, as a decision to say, you know what, I remember my mother-in-law telling us, I'm just not going to go up that road to come down it again. The road she was talking about was chemotherapy. I'm just not going to do it again. It was awful. I hated it. She then went on to tell us about all the women friends she had at church that she just watched get smaller and smaller and smaller and die by inches, and she didn't want it. And every one of us in the family was ready to jump on that call and start screaming back, no, 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 you know, encourage her, call the oncologist. And thankfully, we had enough sense to just not do that for a minute.
Yeah.
And realize it was her choice.
And breathe.
And breathe. And realize that, you know, the 75 years of her life, which were amazing, even though she came from a line of women who all lived into their 90s and whooped you at Scrabble in 95, right? Maybe that wasn't going to be, but that the life we shared was amazing.
Yeah.
She also thought Mother's Day was a shill perpetrated by Hallmark cards.
It is.
Yep. She died on Mother's Day. And she was actually someone everybody called mother. So I've had years and years and years since 1989 to thank her every time Mother's Day comes around. and to feel sad.
Luis, you had your hand up? And then Paula?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, Jane, since you start talking today, I was listening to the Serenity Prayer, I mean, all the time, everything you said. And one new angle that I got is that acceptance doesn't mean that you stop trying, which is a different angle for me because, I mean, I tend to look, oh, yeah, I cannot do anything about this, so forget it. But if you continue trying, at what moment do you, at some moment you stop being respectful of what you cannot change? I mean, being respectful of what you cannot change is important. But if you keep trying and trying and trying, then you start losing that respect. So how do you get the wisdom when to stop, if ever? That, I don't know.
Well, and I think there's a line in the Serenity Prayer that I'd add. I mean, I know the attribute that I'd put in there. I just don't know what the rest of the line is. The attribute would be humility. My dad's sobriety, which came at age 50, resulted in 41 years of engagement with 12-step programs in AA that were very much for him religion. And I watched him go in the middle of the night to do anything. He'd come to some setting that I just started working in, and within no time, he knew loads of people there that I didn't know yet, because they all had addiction issues. But I think the question of humility is really one of saying, is somehow related to this question of when do you stop trying? Because acceptance, if it comes too soon, is, you know, sort of resignation. And I don't think the Serenity Prayer is about resignation. So I think we learn about acceptance by trying when we're humble enough to do that. Right? And I think it's a part of what's in the Flores poem about the flame tree. Right? The guy is going to take the tree down because it's full of termites and it's going to blow over, and that's clearly the right thing to do. But he's forgotten about those defiant orange blossoms that are keeping a dying woman alive. And what is the balance there? Is it worth the risk of the tree blowing over so that she can have color in her life? And I don't know the answer to my own question. But I feel like the tree answers it by saying, well, you tried to kill me, but I'm back. And I have to say, of several of the trumpet vines and various other things, I'm sure none of you have bittersweet in your garden. But honestly, man, I have ripped stuff out of my garden. There's a weed called a gout weed. That darn thing, I swear at night, it just plots under my bed to come back in the corner. And I rip it out, and it's back. So some of that trying bit is no. I'm coming after you again, right? And I don't know if the guy's coming back with more poison for that tree. And we know her mom isn't coming back. But the orange flowers, maybe a less threatening tree you can allow to flower and keep the bridge open to the person you loved. I don't know. But I love the fact that that tree gets the last word. So I succeeded in not answering your question, right?
Some questions are like that, you know.
Well, the Serenity Prayer, you are completely right to hear that. And it's in everything I do. It is literally, such as I can remember prayers beyond the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm, it's my prayer. It's my go-to.
Janet, how did you happen to listen in to Agnes DeMille and Martha Graham as they were talking?
Oh, lots of websites that I hang out on. That one is called Marginalian.
Me too.
Yeah, Brain Pickings.
Yes, it's fabulous.
Lisa Popova, who, honest to goodness, I don't know where in the world God was keeping her for part of my life, but I hadn't found her for a while. And then about, is it 10 years? Maybe she's
It's 15 years old.
It's just remarkable.
Yeah.
Stuff that she leads me to and takes me on event. I'm so glad that lots of people know her, but if they don't, you should definitely find her, buy her books. She's a bit of a nut job in places, but boy, what a smart woman. Oh my
God. It's endless though.
It is endless. It's like dropping down Alice's rabbit hole, right? I could be gone for days. But she's led me to pieces that I just cherish.
Does she do Brain Pickings or is hers separate?
Brain Pickings is where you can start, but Marginalian comes in the middle of the week.
They're related too.
She changed the whole name, to Marginalian from Brain Pickings, but it's all referenced backwards, right?
Yes.
And the archives of these things are just, I just don't know that I've ever met anybody who's as literate as she is.
Right.
So Paula, your hand was up.
I was going to say, let me just say one thing about Marginalia and Maria Popova. I used to work with a lot of archivists at Harvard, and archivists really, really know how to find things. And when I first started reading her, I said, oh my God, this is someone who knows how to find treasures, that cultural treasures. And, you know, when you go into her website, you can be deep into links and deep into stuff. And it's true. Where does she find them? But I think she really knows. There's something intellectually solid. And I tell you the truth, she really talks a lot about or refers a lot to grief and loss. A lot.
Yeah.
And trees.
Children's
and trees.
And trees.
Yes.
Trees.
Yes.
And science. Right?
Yeah.
She's a big
the cosmos.
Yep. She's very into women and women authors and writers and but the other thing is for those of us who are just so indebted to her, for the links can be bottomless. You can stay forever. But they're so easy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. She does it's a really great job on all levels as an archivist. And wow.
Another person I would definitely direct people to, if you love Maria, is, if you don't know her already, is Krista Tippett. Krista is a Brown graduate from 1981. She studied history and German, and her work on being, the wisdom site she has up now. I mean, hardiness, as we've been talking about it, it's important to line up resources for yourself that come to you pretty easily, because when we most need help with hardiness, it seems to me, is when we don't feel very hardy.
Yeah.
Right? And COVID has been such an isolating, difficult time for so many, to have these wonderful web-based resources that can come for no money and, you know, take you down on wonderful adventures for hours of time, music and poetry and so
we need to support her though, please.
Yes.
She depends on that.
Yes. The subscriptions matter, and they really make a difference in terms of how durable these resources will be.
Yes.
Paula, you had something else.
I just wanted to say, Janet, I just wanted to thank you for how your mother planted gardens and just the way that you threaded the garden and your mother and everything through this talk. It really gave me lots of food for thought. And I also really, really appreciate the serendipity that you talked about your mother where I left off about mine. That was
I was going to say the exact, I did say it, but I'll say it again. To log on and hear you talking about your mom, I thought, I am so grateful to the universe and to you for.
Yes, I love that kind of serendipity. And it's happened, it's actually happened quite a bit through the years at Women Explore and TOP. Mm-hmm. So I just want to thank you very much for everything you said. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I look forward to this group always. It just is a wonderful collection of human beings. And each time somebody comments, I think, I want to know more about that person.
Well, the second part of our couplet, so you were the first part of our couplet. The second part is going to be our session, our last session next week in this series called Taking Action. And we have three women, Virginia, Ivel, and Mary Rose are going to do maybe a 5, 6, 7 minute focus on some way that they're taking action in the realm of friendship, distraction, and hardiness. And then we're asking that the rest of us really be thinking in this next week how this series has affected us, what we're doing as a response, and we're going to each contribute, hopefully, a story either about an action that we've taken or one that we feel stuck about taking. And so we have some questions to offer you to think about, and you don't have to write them down because Martha, bless her, will send them out sometime at the end of this week so that you'll have them in person. But here are the questions. What action have you taken to better tend a friendship in your life with others, a friendship with nature, a friendship with yourself? So this is in the last 10 weeks. What subtraction action have you taken to have more time or energy to give to a friendship? What time draining distractions have you become aware of and taken an action to decrease or eliminate in your life? What action have you taken to discern for you the difference between distractions that rob you of what you desire and the distractions that nurture you? In play, in resilience, relaxation, laughter, or restoration? How has your understanding or clarity about hardiness developed over these 10 weeks? What actions towards more personal hardiness have you taken physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually? Is there an action in friendship, distraction, or hardiness that you had that has become clear to you, although you have not yet acted on it? And what support do you need to take this action? And we could add another question, which is what action would help your unique gift come forward, as Martha Graham says, your unique gift. So those are things to think about between now and next week. And we will be creating a quilt of these things as we share our own experiences in our final session.